All the bills before us today are just to be laid over for possible inclusion. First on the docket is House File 1148, Representative Murdoch. Representative Murdoch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1148 deals with landfills. Back in November, I was contacted by Mike Cannon. He's the solid waste director for Wadena and Otter Tail County. And we had a little storm up in Wadena County on June 17th of last year with that big tornado. And then to my right, I have Jeff Lewis from MPCA. And the bill came to me through Mike. I guess I'll just let these gentlemen explain the bill. It's MPCA's language. They're fine with it. So I'll just let them explain.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity today. I'd like to also thank Representative Murdoch. As Representative Murdoch said, my name is Mike Hanen. I'm the Solid Waste Administrator for Otter Tail, Todd, and Wadena Counties. And as Representative Murdoch said, a large share of eastern Otter Tail County and western Wadena County was severely impacted last June 17th by a tornado that went through our area. In response to the cleanup of the tornado, the two counties in the city got together and developed a temporary debris management site. And since that time, we've been doing a lot of work on managing the debris from the tornado. We've got a lot of work left to do. But and just to give the board the committee a little information, we've got about 80,000 cubic yards of organic material, mostly tree waste, that we're recycling. We've got about another 80,000 cubic yards of concrete and masonry debris that we're recycling. Got about 60,000 cubic yards of metal that we're recycling, and probably about 5,000 cubic yards of shingles that we're recycling. Unfortunately, we've also got about 80,000 yards, or in excess of 80,000 yards, of building materials that we, as a part of our bid process, did put it out for recycling reuse. This point, haven't gotten any response to that, and what it looks like we're going to be doing with it is taking it to the Wadena County demolition landfill. And just for reference purposes, I think you do have a map of the Wadena County demolition landfill, and what we're really talking about is taking the property directly to the west of that property that's highlighted in blue and utilizing it for disposal of the demolition debris. And just for reference, the Wadena Demo Landfill is a very, very small landfill. Usually takes in about 6,000 cubic yards a year of demolition debris. And as I mentioned, we've probably got over 80,000 cubic yards of material that we need to deal with based on from the tornado last year. Along with the assistance from the MPCA, we've been able to develop our temporary debris management site. We've been able to segregate a lot of materials and do a lot of work on site. And also cooperatively, we've approached our legislators, Representative Murdoch here, and asked for assistance in acquiring some of the property that's directly west of that. And I think I'll let Mr. Lewis speak in reference to that, because it is property that's managed by the state of Minnesota right now.
Welcome, Mr. Lewis.
Thank you, Chairman McNamara. My name is Jeff Lewis, and I manage the closed landfill program at the MPCA. We wanted to give you this map to kind of try and explain what's going on this site. Our agency was responsible for managing about 112 old landfills. These were mostly the first generation landfills that came in. When those sites came into our program, we basically had old permits for them that we were working under, and the land that was covered under those old permits were transferred to our program. We have about 8,000 acres that are currently in our program. Only about 2,000 acres of that contain waste. The remaining parcels are land that either was at one time expected to be under those permits or buffer areas that we acquired. When the statute was put together in 1994, it was basically an all or nothing. The sites came into our program with everything that was under the permit, or they stayed out. And we never really had a good way of carving off small pieces of those sites that we didn't need. On the map that was left on your chair, that heavy black dashed line is what we call our land management area. That was the part of the site that came into our program. The area in blue there in the kind of the upper right-hand side that said CLP waste, that's the garbage that's left on that site. Everything else within that hashed area we were responsible for, but we really don't need that much property in order to maintain and take care of the waste that's there. So this legislation would basically give us the ability to work with local units of government to carve off pieces that we don't need and return for other uses. We have about four different sites that we're currently working with under something similar to this. Besides our Wadena landfill, we have one in Winona where we're working with Winona County, Waseca, and Cook County. Those four sites that we all are working with them on some other use of the property that part of which came into our program. The other thing we're hoping this legislation will allow us to do is we do have about 9 sites in our program that we picked up and moved to other locations. Those sites are all cleaned up now, but we don't have a good way of really carving them back out of the program once we're done with that. And so the second part of this legislation would give us the ability to, once we're done with those sites, to basically delist them out of the program and return them to the local units of government. I guess that's about it, and if there are questions, we could certainly try and answer them.
Representative Wagenius. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have questions for both of our witnesses, if that's all right.
Sure, go ahead, Representative Wagenius.
For Mr. Hannon in Otter Tail County, you have this waste that can't be recycled. Does it have a possibility of leaching at all, since it's going, I assume it's going into an unlined landfill?
Mr. Hannon.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, it is demolition debris and by definition is considered to be inert materials, but primarily what it is walls, ceilings, and floors of a building, and your assumption is correct, it is going into an unlined demolition landfill.
Representative Wagenius.
But my question was, does this material have a possibility of leaching into the groundwater?
Mr. Hannon.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius. I'm not a scientist, but typically the more inert materials, the less opportunity they have to leach. I'm not going to try to convince anybody that has no opportunity for leaching. There probably is some.
Representative Wagenius.
Then let me go over and talk a little bit with PCA. When we initially did the landfill cleanup program, it was all about groundwater, and so I you didn't mention groundwater at all, so maybe the surface is fine, but if you are giving pieces of property to a local community, is that groundwater under that property uncontaminated?
Mr. Lewis.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, none of the areas that we are proposing to carve off and give back to local units of government have any contamination, either on the surface or are susceptible to any of the gas migration issues that we have around landfills or have any groundwater contamination. Any of those areas that have either groundwater contamination or gas issues, we would keep in the program. We would not be carving them off.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we're going to go the route of this bill, it seems to me we should put in language that precludes them from carving out any land that has groundwater contamination issues, because the liability issues just kind of boggle my mind there. So it would seem to be a fairly simple amendment that people have time to think about, since it's going to be laid over for possible inclusion. Does that make sense to you, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wagenius, it certainly would be something that we could consider, and you certainly would be able to work with Representative Murdoch if you want to see if you want to craft an amendment and it would certainly be in order for that. Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you. I think that's a kind of thing that PCA could do along with our staff if they were willing to do that kind of thing to make sure that I understand what their plan is now, but we're doing something long term, and the statute should reflect the long term and not the short term. I am concerned about the leaching if we're having old buildings. Do you know what's the situation with the groundwater underneath this particular landfill?
Mr. Lewis, first, did you want to comment on Representative Wakinius' first thoughts on an amendment? I saw you looking like you maybe wanted to make a comment. Mr. Lewis.
Chairman McNamara, we'd be happy to work with Representative Murdoch on some changes. I think to us, when we talk about a qualified facility, that to us means the contamination. So you're right. To us, I think it was clear that we wouldn't be giving away, but it wouldn't be hard to put some language in. We were under the second part on the delisting activities. I think there is language in there about it having to be clean, but to us, that qualified facility meant that same thing. But we can work to make that a little bit clearer. On the second question, the groundwater on this site basically goes off in a west-southwest direction, northwest, I'm sorry, towards the creek up in the corner of the picture there.
Oh, good.
So one of the other things that we tried to do when we look at separating off areas is that we have to have enough separation distance based on the groundwater flow to be able to identify if there is a problem down the road, whether it would be Mike's problem or our problem. So we do maintain monitoring systems between the two areas and would be able to pinpoint any problems that do develop down the road.
Thank you. I have a question, Mr. Hannon. There's some facilities, I'm familiar with one near my district that has a rather large sorting machine. Did you look at that opportunity to bring in a machine to sort this building debris if it was the quantity you're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, actually, we pre-sorted a lot of the debris when it came to the site. That's how we got the piles that were concrete, steel, tree waste, and demolition debris. We actually bid this out in... the first time in October of last year, asking for proposals for firms interested in coming out and sorting the material and then disposing of it or processing it in a different manner than landfilling it. We didn't get any, so we recently bid it out again, and the options that came back this second time are for disposal in the landfill.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Representative Murdoch, will hold over House File 1148 for possible inclusion, and if you and Mr. Lewis could work with Representative Wagenius, that would be good. Thank you. Next, we have House File 1115. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative McFarland, House File 1243, White Bear Lake Conservation District Authority Modified. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you want to move the amendment or the bill?
Representative McFarland, you have an amendment to get the bill in the shape
No. No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative McFarland, we're just I can move House File 1243, but it's just for possible inclusion in a omnibus bill later on. Representative McFarland, to your House File 1243.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a small bill that just helps to clarify the current statute that we have for the White Bear Conservation District, and it adds just four words and set service fees. And I would like to introduce Alan Catrood, the legal counsel for the White Bear Conservation District, who can answer, can kind of fill you in on the background and answer any questions.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Cantrude. If you could identify yourself for the record, and seeing how it's four words, you probably don't have to do a lot of explaining. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Alan Cantrude. I've been counsel to the White Bear Lake Conservation District for about 10 years. And, as such, this is before you essentially to clarify the language in the enabling statute for the Conservation District. And I'm happy to answer your questions.
Questions? Thank you, Representative McFarland. We'll hold your bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Next, Representative Poppy, as long as you're here. Representative Anderson, you've got to be here, you and I, so we must let Representative Poppy get on the road if she's that far along. Representative Poppy, House File 111. Representative Hansen or Representative Wagenius or Knut, when do you want to just move the bill for possible inclusion?
I'll move House File 111 for possible inclusion.
Okay. Welcome, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for the opportunity to present House File 111, which would designate the Cedar River in southern Minnesota as a state water trail. Today I have Justin Hansen with me, and he's actually going to describe it a little bit further. And there is a handout that you should have, a pretty colorful handout.
Excuse me, just for a minute. Members, I'm going to officially bring the meeting to order. Go ahead, introduce yourself for the record and give your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Poppy. My name is Justin Hansen. I work with the Maurer Soil and Water Conservation District. I'm here today representing the Cedar River Watershed District to talk to you all a little bit about the Cedar River, and I appreciate the opportunity to meet with you all. The Cedar River is located in south-central Minnesota. It's a benchmark idea for you all. It runs through the city of Austin and on the northern end includes Blooming Prairie, so runs into Iowa as part of the big Red Cedar River system. We don't have a lot of lakes in Maurer County, so people are drawn to the recreational opportunities that we have, which is primarily the Cedar River. We understand that it's ag country down there, it's corn and soybeans, and we're all proud of that. I think what gets missed oftentimes is the gem that we have in the Cedar River. People who get on and that we've talked with talk about the difference between the agricultural land and once you're actually down and in the Cedar, it feels like you're going into almost a different area of the state. And we're very proud of that. What we're looking to do is just showcase some of that. You know, a lot of people look at the Cedar River and maybe don't stop as they're passing through on I-90. We want to create an opportunity for people to take advantage of it and have more outreach with some of the other people in the state, as well as grow the opportunities for our local land users. So what we're proposing is a designation as a state water trail. The good news for all of you is that there isn't a large sum of money that we're asking for as part of this designation. In working and partnering with our DNR contacts on this, they were able to work this designation in any maps or any web development that would go as part of it could just be absorbed into their funds as it is right now. So we're not asking for any extra money. We're just more so asking for the opportunity to have the designation, to use that designation as a tool for partnering with our conservation districts in the area, our many conservation local organizations, Isaac Walden League, Pheasants Forever, and such, and keep building on the opportunities that we've already been doing. If you look on the back side of that handout, we talk a little bit about some of the accesses that are already in place. We, as part of our conservation programs, we've been taking easements, and the county's got involved with purchasing property in the floodplain, and we want to take these areas, use the designation, and use some of our local partners to create more access opportunities, fishing piers, things like that. Keeping the waters navigable for the folks who are visiting in our area so that they have the opportunity to enjoy the time that they spend on the Cedar. With that, I guess, just to wrap up, we have a great resource. We want to showcase that resource to the rest of the state, and we appreciate your support.
Questions for Mr. Hansen? Representative Hoppe, did you want to? I'm sorry. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. I'm assuming that the DNR is okay with this and they're totally on board. And
we've been working with the DNR from the beginning on this, actually, and that's it was even their recommendation. They came back and said, you know, for the limited amount of funds that it takes that are associated with this designation, they're okay with the commitment.
Representative Scott, and they are sitting behind you in the audience, and they did nod yes to that question, but if you want them to testify further, they certainly are here and willing. Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious what that limited amount of funds is. I know we don't have a fiscal note here, but I know you elaborated on some, but you didn't really quantify. So.
Right. There was a fiscal note for the Senate hearing.
Mr. Potter or Mr. Simon, do you want to come down and just ask what would be involved in this designation? I know the testifier has said that you said you could incorporate it in your website.
Mr. Chairman, Ron Potter, Parks and Trails of the DNR, Representative McNamara. The fiscal note was like we estimated about $10,000, but we have some funding left from a previous designation on the North Crow, and that we can use that funding for to cover the mapping that's required for this designation. So we feel we have adequate funding to cover this.
Thank you. Additional questions? Representative Hackbart.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm wondering, when you make this designation, what kind of are there any restrictions that are put on landowners along the river, along the shoreline, if we enact this designation? I know if you do certain things in some areas, if you designate something in certain ways, other areas of statute, we put restrictions on landowners, private landowners, on what they can do with their land, etc. Are we doing anything like that under this designation?
Representative Poppy?
I will ask Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Hansen.
And I would...
Mr. Potter.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hackworth. No, under this program, it basically is more of a tourism activity. It's not like the Wild and Scenic, where there's actually some stipulations placed on the land. No, this is more of a promotion of the resource.
Thank you.
And Mr. Potter, how many of these do we have across the state?
Mr. Chairman, I believe this brings us up to 27.
And Mr. Potter, if I'm trying to remember, is this one that was in the west suburbs? There was somebody had asked to get this and we denied them, or am I getting things mixed up? I'm thinking Representative Szymanski one time had, was that not a water trail that there was question about whether there was some different local units of government involved? I might be getting things mixed up. Might have been a scenic river one then, because there are some requirements in that.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Yeah, okay. I don't remember any.
All right, thank you. Additional questions? Thank you, Representative Poppy. It'll be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we have Representative Anderson, Adopt a Wildlife Management Area. Oh, this is why Mr. Simon's here. Okay. All right. Representative Anderson, if you want to move your bill for possible inclusion.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would move House File 1115 for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill before us.
Okay. Representative Anderson, to your bill.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. What this bill would do, it says that the commissioner shall coordinate through regional offices at the DNR and encourage interested groups or people to assist on a volunteer basis in helping to improve and maintain wildlife management areas throughout the state. And one thing the bill would not do, it wouldn't save the state any money, because what the bill is aimed at is working at WMAs where currently funding is not available to maintain these areas. So this would be targeted to areas that are not being maintained and have volunteer people go in there at the direction of the DNR to work on these areas on a volunteer basis.
Thank you.
I have with me a DNR to speak to the bill.
Mr. Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dennis Simon. I'm the Wildlife Management Section Chief for DNR's Division of Fish and Wildlife. Mr. Chair and members, the concept of adopt a wildlife management area program has been around for a long time. Informally, we've been implementing it for decades. When I was in the field, I had a number of clubs that I worked with routinely to do these very types of things. This bill would formalize the program and implement it eventually statewide. As Representative Anderson mentioned, we view this as a supplemental program, not just simply doing things that we're currently doing with different staff, but this would truly add to the work that we're doing on wildlife management areas. One of the issues, of course, that we need to deal with is just the range of activities that volunteers, untrained volunteers, can do. Certainly there's trash pickup, there's simple repairs of fencing and signage, replacing of damaged signs, any other work that would, and then physical work, such as brushing out buckthorn and invasive species and that kind of thing, planting trees. Any other work that would require mechanical training, certifications, licenses, pesticide applicator licenses, equipment operation certification would require us to either get those people trained, somebody trained, or would require trained staff to work alongside the groups. As you're probably well aware, the state is self-insured, so the Section of Wildlife would take on some liability in workers' comp and tort claim liability if anything were to happen on the site during one of our supervised activities. And as we all know, there really is no free lunch. So even though we're talking about adding additional work, getting additional work done in our wildlife management areas, there is some cost to a program like this. We originally developed a fiscal note that envisioned an actively managed and promoted statewide program, fully engaged and fully subscribed. And the fiscal note was quite high on it. And working with the Senate authors on companion bill, we scaled that back down to something that would be more realistic for sort of a startup program in the first couple years of the biennium. The fiscal note is $20,000, of which $10,000 of that $20,000 would be simply reallocation of existing staff time to help us manage the paperwork, the contracts, the personal protective equipment, and getting the people out there in the right place. The other $10,000 of the fiscal note would be new dollars that we would need to come up with to provide the signage, the personal protective equipment such as eye protection, hard hats where necessary, tick repellent, and those kinds of things, particularly in the Lyme's disease endemic zone, and then recognition for all the work that the volunteers would do and just sort of processing the paperwork so we can report back. That's all I really have for the Adopt a Wildlife Management Program, if anybody has any questions.
Yes, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I think citizens do want to help out here, so I'm glad to see this. My question is, it's in accordance with plans devised by the commissioner, and I think that is extremely important, but one of the things I know we have to plan to do a lot more of is burning. How does that fit into this? Are you going to be training volunteers to help with burns, or is this kind of off the table because of liability? What's the status here?
Mr. Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wagenius, burning, as we all know, is a very high-risk activity, and it's probably the activity within the section of wildlife that requires the highest level of training. We don't let anybody work on a fire line unless they've had at least the two basic fire courses of what we call S-130 and S-190. If we have volunteers who have had that level of coursework, either through schooling or prior jobs, we would allow them to help us work on the line. However, without that training, we just can't take that level of risk. So burning is one of those activities that we have felt for some time really is best suited for department activities or contractors that have the kind of training.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, we're going to need to have you work on the fiscal note issues with Mr. Simon if we're going to be moving the bill. I don't know if the groups can incur those expenses that Mr. Simon talked about or what the issues are, but where we're in the budget process, if there's going to be a fiscal note, we're going to have problems. So if you could work with that and identify some possible sources or ways if the groups, you know, if a local Pheasants Forever chapter is willing to do the signage or whatever and incur those expenses. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, would that be the entire $20,000 or the $10,000 that would be the actual financial outlay by the DNR?
Representative Anderson, I think Mr. Simon has said they can take care of the $110,000. Mm-hmm. So it's, I mean, he talked specifically about, you know, tick spray and signs and, you know, staples to repair fence and stuff. I think it's possible that a local PF or DU chapter, if they're interested, say you got a local sportsman's club, they may be willing to incur those expenses themselves as we get this program going. So we may need to note that as we move forward, because we won't be able to have one that has some fiscal costs. Representative Hackbart.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think the question is to Representative Anderson. Was this a department bill that came forward, or did somebody bring this bill to you? I have a little bit of a problem whenever I see political statements and purposes and things like that in bills. I don't know why that got in there. You're really repeating yourself in Subdivision 3. Mr. Chairman, I'd either like to make a motion now to delete Subdivision 2, or if Mr. Representative Anderson would like to change that when he comes back to the committee next time, I'm willing to do that. But
thoughts either Representative Anderson or Mr. Simon on the purpose statement?
I would have no problem deleting lines 1.9 to 1.11.
Mr. Chairman, I make that motion to delete Subdivision 2 and renumber the section.
Okay. Discussion?
Pardon me?
Well, we actually did move the bill before us. Actually, we did, so it's fine. Why don't we get it in the shape that we're all talking about? It'll make us that much easier. We're going to have an intense week as it is. Representative Hackbart's moved to delete subsection 2, lines 1.9 through 1.11. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Okay. Representative Hanson.
Thank you.
We're having a hard time reading Ms. Rudolph's writing there. It's been long. She needs the week off.
Mr. Simon, to wait for just a bit on this.
I think there is a couple more questions, yeah. Representative Anderson. There's at least a couple members have questions. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson or Mr. Simon. You'd mentioned about cost with doing the paperwork and oversight. What are the requirements on site? And I would assume that the cost or the potential cost drivers are DNR staff being on site for supervision, or what's that role of direct supervision with any of these tasks?
Mr. Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hanson, I think it, as envisioned, as if we have a statewide actively managed program that was pretty much fully subscribed, we would have a salaried DNR staff person on site for every one of these projects, or most of them anyway, to direct the work. However, we don't have the staff to add this additional burden to our existing staff. So what we'd be looking at doing is designing a program that would have a list of activities designed by our area wildlife staff, locations where that work could be done, and I would solicit volunteer regional coordinators from the various groups, particularly the Deer Hunters Association, who seem to be most active, and ask them to do the coordination, ask them to bring the volunteers out to the site and to be the on-site sort of supervisor of the program. Now, that's all assuming that this is all handwork, there's no mechanical or chemical or licensed operation that needs to be done. If we had a project that did require the operation of a tractor, say planting trees, then we'd have to have a salaried DNR staff person on site. Our experience has been that volunteers want to work on Saturdays and Sundays, so we'd have to make allowances for that in our scheduling.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Simon, I'm curious about the, and I didn't catch all of it. You said you had $10,000 that you wouldn't need as part of the, that you'd be able to get internally or something. I'm kind of curious where that's coming from, whether that's, you know, unused staff capacity that you have now in the DNR, or where that might come from. I can't understand, you know, $10,000 just materializing. The other question I have is, is related to, you know, what happens, and, you know, I like the idea of reaching out to groups. We need to do it, and we need to, unfortunately, when government does a lot of these things, they these programs that look to be bare bones eventually get to be a full-fledged, full-staff issue later on. At least that's been the experience that I've observed. But what happens, you get down the road, and you've got a volunteer group working in a particular area, and as we know with volunteers, their interest sometimes ebbs and flows. You know, is there the potential or is there not the potential that they could be going in and making these improvements and suddenly they're not interested in doing this work anymore, and there's a liability that then would exist for state government to come in and continue to maintain or whatever improvements that they might have done that wouldn't be a cost to the government otherwise?
Mr. Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ruskowski, to your first question, we would redirect existing staff to manage this startup program. We think the effort would be relatively modest, maybe 100 hours or so from somebody in the central office in St. Paul, and maybe up to another 100 or 200 hours, something like that, of staff time in each of the four regions. And we would redirect staff from doing existing work to this new startup program. If it's in statute, we need to do it. To answer your second question, I think the activities that we would be asking these groups to do particularly would not bind us to any future liability. We're looking at relatively straightforward maintenance activities or one-time enhancement activities that really wouldn't create a liability down the road. You are right that our experience has been that over time, various groups ebb and wane with their interest in the program, and so we would look to volunteer coordinators to try and either keep that enthusiasm going with the clubs that they get signed up, or look for substitute clubs so that we don't end up with the big voids in our management activities because we now have nobody to do the work.
Mr. Simon, to that point, you could easily have a situation where today these people have to go out and do the work, where now you may be able to work with some volunteers that will get the work done, that may allow you to get work done in two or three WMAs instead of the person having to go out and actually do the work themselves. So potentially by you reallocating your staff time, you may actually be able to capitalize on volunteers that are capable to remove the buckthorn or invasive trees or whatever, some of the more simplistic things I would imagine. I mean, I've certainly seen yours and U.S. Fish and Wildlife staff out doing that kind of work in WPA and WMAs, so I would think that this is something, as you said, by going at it slow and gradual and capitalize on those organizations, you may be able to actually get more work done and make the land better and not increase costs to the state.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with you. I think initially what we'd be looking at doing is reducing the frequency that our staff go out and replace signs. So instead of our staff doing it every 4 years or so, we would now be able to have volunteers help us and do it every year. And so I think the quality of the maintenance would improve on each of the WMAs where they participate in. And eventually, as you say, we would hope that there's enough training and expertise in these volunteer groups that actually be able to pick up some of the activities that we're currently doing and save the state some money.
Did you have more, Representative Drazkowski?
No, thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I was glad to see Representative Hackbarth take away the purpose statement, not for the reason he said, but because one of the things that I saw that was missing here was like high school biology or college biology teachers who would be using the site as a learning site. And while the students may change, that teacher may be there for years and years and years. And I would hope that there would be some outreach to high school and college biology folks for this. I think that's been successful in other areas.
Is that something you're interested in?
Mr. Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative McGinnis, you're correct. We've had long-standing relationships with a number of professors, particularly at colleges and in some local high schools, that have expressed a real interest in that outdoor learning environment. I think this would provide a more formal structure for it and provide an opportunity for them to be recognized for that level of effort.
Mr. Simon, along those lines, I would recommend you remember the name Joe Beatty is a field biology teacher in Hastings, and his students spend lots of time in the local WMA and the local Vermilion River doing great volunteer work, working with Friends of the Mississippi planting. I think they're going out in the week after we get back. Unfortunately, they're not going out next week, but he does a class that meets in the spring and in the fall and meets at what they call zero and first hour. Then the students get off during the winter, their first hour, but they do exactly the kind of stuff Representative Wagenius is talking about. And Mr. Beatty has received a number of awards for the monitoring they're doing on the Vermilion River, where, FYI, they're noting that the river is improving, the only trophy trout stream in a major metropolitan area in the entire United States, and they're monitoring that now for, I would say, probably approaching at least a decade he's been working, and a kind of a volunteer example where they go out and get volunteers to buy some of their equipment, their waders and their nets to test and tape measures to measure and all that, but then the students are basically doing this and it gets their interest in it. So it's exactly the kind of stuff that Representative Wagenius, Representative Anderson's talking about. I think with that, members, we have one more bill. I'm sorry. Good. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Simon. The last bill is a House File 882. It's my bill. Mr. Botzik, if you want to come forward, it's a bill, members, that needs some additional work. If it does come back, it'll come back in a little bit different format with some tweaks to it. Mr. Botzik, if you want to explain the bill, and then if there are any members in the audience that want to testify about concerns with the bill, that would work great. Mr. Botzik, to House File 882.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present House File 882. Just retroactively to Representative Anderson's bill, the Minnesota Conservation Federation, who I'm here representing today, is wholeheartedly behind your bill. And you look at 200-300+ sportsmen's clubs throughout Minnesota, all the way from New Brighton, Minnesota, to Belle Plaine and Prior Lake and New Market, all in Scott County, very wildlife management oriented and interested, and have relationships built up with teachers already and would be standing by to help on this project. So we're very excited about that. Speaking of a sportsman's club, as I mentioned, the Minnesota Conservation Federation's primary membership is made up of sportsmen's clubs. We have 40-50 of them throughout through our membership, and we have a process each year where people from those sportsmen's clubs can bring resolutions, and this is how this legislation came forward as a real grassroots local sportsmen's clubs initiative. This one comes out of New Market Sportsmen's Club, as I mentioned, one of the three we have in Scott County. I was having this speech for Representative Beard, but he chose not to be here today, so I'll have to personalize them with this. But basically what this does, and we have in statute now provisions that require nesting protection for our wildlife and songbirds in outstate Minnesota. This is for no mowing outstate right now, current law, mowing allowed in the public right-of-way ditches till the end of July. And this legislation would extend that to the metro area for stormwater retention ponds. And you folks that are from the seven-county metro area are very much aware of what a stormwater retention pond does and some of the functions it provides. Interestingly enough and coincidentally enough, it is also now bringing some habitat functions and functionality, and we think can be expanded and improved for the citizens that live around it and enjoy it. And that could be done very inexpensively with some of the similar provisions that we have outstate, and basically saying don't mow or uproot some of that stormwater retention pond as far as establishing a buffer. Now, I understand there's some current concerns about it. I think you're going to hear about them in a second, and we're willing to work with those. But the dates are a little bit maybe a month long based on the outstate provision. DNR has indicated they like what we're doing here, and we think this is a good idea to improve and expand wildlife. As I say, wildlife, this is good for ducks. This is good for songbirds as well. And I don't think it would increase roadkill. I mean, we're all thinking about all those deer that we see dead on the roads. Deer aren't going to hang out at a stormwater retention pond. Ducks do. I talked to a DNR person today about geese problems. They said geese don't like the tall grass, you know, so that would help the geese move them back to different waters further away from the highway. So we are concerned about the roadkill scenario, but we don't think this would contribute extraordinarily to that problem that already exists. So, Mr. Chairman, I think I'd stop there and take any questions and let you get to any other testimony.
Well, you know what, Mr. Bacek, why don't we, is there questions for Mr. Bacek? Otherwise, I think there are a few folks that may want to testify. Mr. Johnson, do you want to come down and testify? And then I'm not sure if there are any other folks. I've heard from a few other about some concerns. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson, representing League of Minnesota Cities, and appreciate the chair bringing this forward for discussion. Just to be clear, the cities that are affected by this are in the Seven County metro area and Duluth and Rochester, and all of those communities already are required to have a federal MPDS Phase 2 stormwater permit that includes demonstrating they're meeting best management practices for running of their stormwater system. So that said, in many of the cities that have had a chance to respond over the last couple of days since this bill came up in the metro area, Maplewood, Shoreview, Roseville, many others, where they have new development that has happened, they have been able to get easements on the development around that that allow a buffer strip, and they've done that. But a lot of these ponds were built in the 70s. The easements that exist onto the property around them don't allow that level of restriction on it. It's just a no development easement. We would have to do some significant work on changing easements, or we would have to pass and enforce local ordinances on private property owners. That's one of the issues I had, Mr. Chair, with the language in the bill, is it is a little unclear. It says if the pond is publicly owned, but it does not say whether the land within the easement or the buffer that's being required is publicly owned. And if this would require us to do enforcement and or easements on those private property owners, it gets to be an expensive and complicated issue very quickly for our communities. Most of our cities are working toward implementing this in a number of ways already on their own properties. I would point out, though, that that's a very small percentage of the stormwater system in this metro area. City of Eden Prairie has over 900 stormwater ponds. Most of those are owned by the development that the pond is in. And those are not included in this. This is only ones where the city owns the pond. And so those situations, even though it's hooked onto the exact same stormwater system, would not be having buffers around them as part of the requirement unless the city has done that in some other way through contracts, development contracts during the construction, something like that. So the main question I got from cities is, why are we doing this? If we could do it on our private property, we already have, and we don't really have the resources to try and enforce it on the private property. So I would add just a couple of technical specific things to the bill that were raised as concerns. Is in subpart 2 under the definition of a stormwater retention pond, it says constructed or maintained to pretreat stormwater. Folks who run the stormwater systems in the metro area said constructed makes sense. Maintained to can suddenly bring in a whole list of other types of waters that we might have very little authority directly adjacent to. So an area that was not specifically constructed for a stormwater discharge holding area, but that is servicing as one, so a naturally occurring one, would be included in this, and we're not entirely sure how we would enforce that on that surrounding area. Second point is just to pick a number. That saying a 10 to 15 foot buffer, there should be a number. It should be 10 or 12 or 11 or 15 or whatever, but the range doesn't help folks. They would be better off served with just a number. I know which one Mr. Bacek will want, that's just fine. The second point is that the restriction on mowing, tilling, trimming, and use of herbicides is going to need some exceptions to it. There are invasive species. There are noxious weeds. We have emerald ash borer. There are trees regularly within these, and especially if we are not allowed to do maintenance of them during the summer months, we'll have some nice tall cottonwoods and buckthorn very quickly in those areas, unless we have really regular annual maintenance of those. And that can be a very expensive thing to try and do, is do the woody plant control on an annual basis. So I think we're going to need to come up with a reasonable exemption if something like this moves forward to allow those types of things to be addressed within the summer season. We also have maintenance issues where at certain times of the year we're going to need to do dredging and other work in the pond, laying up culvert, things like that during these months. And during that time you would need to disturb the vegetation and leave it disturbed for a fairly considerable amount of time to be able to do that. I would just add the final thought on this is that this isn't inconsistent with what we want to be doing around our stormwater ponds at all. But we really think that it's focusing a state mandate on a place where we already have a stormwater permit that can leverage that. The Pollution Control Agency gets those permits. They're reviewed annually. We secondly think that the real area where we most frequently see mowing and treatment of lawns or grass surfaces right to a water body is on private properties. And this doesn't really address that in any way, and nor do we think there's an easy way to do that. That's just not something that, without a pretty significant decision by individuals and who own the property and decide they're going to manage it differently, would realistically happen. Mr. Chair, with that, I just would end by saying I'm going to be happy to work with Mr. Botzek and the other members of the committee on this. None of the points I raised, I think, say that we couldn't go forward with something. It's just we need to make sure it's workable for the local governments without dramatically increasing costs. Frankly, right now, many of my cities are very happy to not mow anywhere near a stormwater pond because it costs money to mow near a stormwater pond, and we're not mowing parks in a lot of cases right now. So we're not mowing around stormwater ponds either. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think they're good points, Mr. Johnson, and thanks for raising them. The reality is sometimes we have to work hard to get cities to realize they have an opportunity to save money and can do less mowing, and it encourages them to do a better practice, save money, and less sediment and all that in the pond. So I appreciate your willingness to work with it. This is a work in progress, and how far it'll go or where it will go at this point, we'll have to see it when we hear your concerns, the county's concerns, as we go forward. Representative Wagin, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, you said that all of the city-owned stormwater ponds have NPDES permits. Did I get that correct?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, all of the cities included in this bill fall under and are required to have a state-approved NPDES stormwater permit. And
Representative Wagenius.
The stormwater ponds in their system are required to be a part of it.
Representative Wagenius.
Then can I make the assumption that none of these ponds with these permits have any problems with PAHs getting into the water?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, no. We've discussed in this committee for a couple of years, we have very significant problems with runoff of contaminants that are causing PAH contaminated levels of soil in our stormwater ponds.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Johnson. I mean, you're saying don't give us any regulation, but what you're doing and what the regulation we have isn't working. So, and not only is it not working, it's costing us a ton of money to then clean up these stormwater ponds when they get filled with toxins. It would seem to me that you should be grateful that Mr. Botzek is coming to you and saying, help me or prevent this problem so that you don't have it in the future. The dots aren't connecting here for me.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, be happy to talk more about it, but the 10-foot buffer strip that would be going around a pond that currently doesn't have one, is very little of that runoff is going to be coming from paved surfaces. That water goes into gutter systems and it drains directly through a pipe into that very same pond, but not over the buffer. It goes in through a pipe underneath the buffer, and that's where we believe, at least our data shows, most of the coal tar-based PAHs are getting in.
Representative Wagenius.
Then, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What are you doing to prevent the problem? I mean, part of it is the solution, obviously, that Mr. Botzig is bringing you. What are you doing to prevent the rest of the problem?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, 2 years, 3 years ago, I guess now, the state passed legislation that required the Pollution Control Agency to do a certain amount of work to develop standards and things on coal tar and to do a study on the impacts of coal tar sealants and PAH levels in stormwater sediment. The League of Cities worked with the PCA to draft a model ordinance that continues to be recommended to cities for how to restrict the use of coal tar asphalt sealants in a way that would prevent that contamination. That continues to be on both the League and the PCA's website. I believe they don't, obviously, the League is not a regulatory body. We're an association, so nobody informs us of when they pass ordinances, but the last time we did an internet search, we had 9 cities that had adopted in the metro area an ordinance prohibiting the use of coal tar sealants on private properties.
Representative Wagenius.
9 out of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I believe about 150.
Thank you. Additional comments? Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, Mr. Chair, and members or anybody, what exactly the motivation is for this bill. Mr. Johnson, is there anything in this bill that your members couldn't do without another state mandate placed upon them?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. And my testimony, the cities are already doing this in their stormwater permits wherever it's feasible to do it, as best I heard from them over the last few days. Most of their comments were, we already do this, what's the problem?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have to comment. I mean, they're not doing a very good job of it. I'm here for the habitat part, and we just covered some of the environmental. You can get 2-for-1, and I don't like mandates any more than you do, Representative, but let's not call it a mandate. Let's call it a best management practice. We can redraft this to give them some direction without causing another mandate. I don't support mandates either. But to say this is something we don't need to force it because they're already doing it, he just, in effect, telling you that it's not really getting done. It's certainly not getting done for habitat, and it appears not to be getting done for environmental quality as well.
Well, Mr. Botzig, I'll just give the short little example of the one I'm familiar with. When I look out my window of my home, I look over a stormwater pond that the city mows, unfortunately, too close on one side. And it happens to be a natural low spot where some of the water runs through, and it's mowed very short, and the geese keep it even shorter because, as you know, if the short grass is down to the edge of the water, the geese will walk right out. They don't want to walk through 15 feet of tall grass because they don't know what coyotes lurking in there. So I spent, I think it was the Sunday before last, fixing the washouts that were caused specifically because the city's mowing too close to the pond. Whereas if they would just stay off the hill and keep it long going into the fall, they should mow it once a year for deciduous weed control and such. But by timing that, and I've worked with the city, it's a job to inform them. Many of them are my generation, and they're just under the philosophical thought process that it looks good to be mowed grass. To them, that looks good. Sometimes we need to give them a little push to realize that maybe they could do a little different. It will save them money, actually. They'll have less work to do and fix it up better, and we could argue what role does government have to do. Well, I think that's our job to try and help. Mr. Johnson raised a number of concerns with the bill that I'm authoring that need to be fixed before it can move forward, because we do not want to make more mandates on them, Representative Jaskowski. You're right. We want to make it work easy with them, but at the same point, sometimes they've got some different ideas on how to do it, and maybe they could change those a little bit. Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate the discussion, but, you know, members, I point to line 1.14, a metropolitan local government shall maintain. Members, that's a mandate. It looks like a mandate. It smells like a mandate. It sounds like a mandate. That's a mandate. And Mr. Botzek, you may not want it to be perceived as a mandate, but it's a mandate. And you know, I'm familiar with BMPs. My background's in agriculture, and you know, we can talk about what BMPs are, but I really believe that the best decisions are made locally, like Chair McNamara pointed out. And you know, maybe as Mr. Botzek, maybe you want to go around and talk to some of the cities that you have issues with, and talk to those folks and make suggestions. But all of these mandates that government places on local units of government, or the federal government places on states throughout the country, start with good intentions and the belief that each of these would be great ideas dreamt up in a room full of people that have election certificates, end up being nothing but huge costs across the state and across the country. And that's what we're seeing over and over again. And this is the wrong direction, but I appreciate your intent.
Well, Representative Draskowski, it's a mandate to do less work. So if that's something that you think requires the city, it's a mandate to do less. So, but we need to do less smart, because the city is saying we can only do less, that they've got to be able to trim the trees or spray the thistle or cut down the buckthorn, and they should be able to do that year-round, and the seasons are probably a little long. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you about your comments about teaching folks to do less and actually get more, which is part of what Mr. Botzek wants to do. But Representative Draskowski, as we talk about the costs, it's also wise to talk about the benefits. And in this case, it may be a tiny amount of cost for huge benefits for our friends who like good habitat, which breeds lots of ducks for great hunting. And I would just remind folks that the area that he's talking about is the Mississippi Flyway. And if we don't have a good place for ducks and et cetera to land, they can't get up into the northern reaches. And so what is happening now is, in my own small district, very in the flyway, trumpeter swans apparently are landing on Lake Hiawatha, tiny little lake, because we don't have enough habitat in the metro area. So what we do have benefits the state entirely, and to the extent we could do a better job, I think it's to the benefit of the folks who actually like the great outdoors and like to hunt.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would just like to make a couple more comments after some of the debate. One is, as my comment stated, we don't oppose having buffers around stormwater ponds where it's appropriate. That was one of my points, is that we frequently do that. What the federal stormwater permit allows, though, is you identify where that would actually make sense as a BMP to meet the requirements of the permit, not to require it on every pond regardless. If you think of many of the suburban stormwater ponds you can picture, it's a ring of 20 houses with a sunken area in their backyards where there's a pond. It's not runoff from the neighborhood that's going there primarily. The pond is just set low, and pipes are running from the surrounding suburban development off of the paved surface, impervious surfaces, into that pond to hold the water. And so in some cases, putting the buffer around it makes sense, and it'd be a good idea. In other places, it might be a challenge, because you then have to try and figure out how you're going to get in there to manage other aspects of it and get across private property to do that. The other point I would just make, we absolutely appreciate the habitat gains you can get from having buffers in certain places. I just want to remind people that these are constructed stormwater ponds. Their purpose is to be part of a pollution treatment system. The water quality in these is supposed to be not very good, or it's not doing its job. We're supposed to keep the water in there, allow some pre-treatment before that water moves into a sensitive natural area to the best we can, and it's a very big challenge for us. We have to be constantly dealing with sedimentation, dealing with having ordinances that restrict various uses of products in our community to limit the chemicals that are ending up in that. changing the mix of salt we use in our roads in the community to deal with chloride issues, lots of things like that that we have to address, but a lot of these are not going to be sustaining wildlife on them on a regular basis. They might be a good resting spot for a duck to land, catch its breath, but they're not going to be supporting good aquatic life and things that would make them a viable habitat source.
Representative Hackbart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Botzik, I know we've had bills like this before, ditch buffers, those kinds of things. Seems to me I've seen this thing around before. Has this been around the block once before? I've seen something like this somewhere.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Botzik.
Representative Hackbart, yes, we had it introduced last cycle. Paul, Representative Gartner from Shoreview introduced it for me, and we didn't get hearings. And Senator Sotvir Chaudhry had it in the Senate, no hearings. But well, we're back trying again.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I had a question for Mr. Johnson, if he could make his way back again. In your example, that brings up, I think, an interesting point with a water retention pond located in the middle of a group of private houses. Does their private land go down to the water's edge, or how close does the private land issue become as it gets nearer to the retention pond?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, in most of those settings, the pond itself is owned by the private property owners. It's the lots are a wedge shape that meets in the middle of the pond.
Mr. Chairman, that's why the bill is drafted to public only, no private whatsoever. We respect that and understand that, and if they go to hell in a handbasket, we can't do much about it. It's private property rights, so that means responsibilities, hopefully.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair, I would recommend that maybe the drafters of the bill go back and look at Representative Anderson's bill earlier, where we get some of those organizations involved, and have them go knock on the doors of those landowners free of any additional mandates, and we could call it the Metropolitan Adopt-a-Duck Program.
All right, thank you. Members, we need to approve the minutes for the April 13th and 14th. Representative Torkelson?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Discussion to the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed,
aye.
Nay. Motion carries. Members, meeting's adjourned. We're going to be back Tuesday morning after Easter at 8:15 in the morning, and we will be meeting each morning, noon, and night that whole week, so we're going to get to know each other pretty well that week, potentially Tuesday through Friday. So we'll try and keep things posted. We've got a number of bills that need to move, not only through this committee, but to a few other stops. So if you've got bills and you're not sure what's going on with them, make sure you ask, so we do everything we should. Have a good week off, members.